to, I have to gamble while I'm there. Just, you know, so I had a couple of bucks in my wallet. So I threw it in the Back to the Future slot machine. And we should do an entire symposium just on Back to the Future sometime. You know? I think that the first Back to the Future film was just a complete work of genius. It was just an amazing movie from beginning to end. Partly because I have a weakness for time travel stories, and that was one of the better constructed time travel stories.
Yes. Time travel also is a big... Okay, so when are we going to know when we get on the... Okay, 15 seconds.
There we go. 15 seconds.
All right.
Well, I will tell you the story when we get back on the air. So when we start on the air. And welcome to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here back on the air again live after my brief hiatus yesterday. I was down in Reno, Nevada. I went down there. I thought about, while I was down there, shooting a man just to watch him die, but decided that that probably not a bad idea. That's one of those things that I think is hard to square with the Catholic faith.
Besides, it's been done.
And it's been done. So I did the other thing that you do in Reno, which is gamble. And so by the way, we're here today with Deacon Stephen Gardonis. He is my interlocutor there on the other end. And so I thought, well, I've never gambled in Reno. Actually, I've never gambled in Nevada. I've been through Vegas once or twice for this and that. And the thing about Nevada is everywhere you go, there are slot machines, including right there in the airport. So you don't have to go anywhere. You just get off the plane, and there's like this huge row of slot machines. So I'm sitting there waiting for my plane, getting ready to leave Reno after I'd gone down there and spoken to a Catholic business group. And so I thought, you got a couple of bucks in your wallet. You should at least say that you've done it. So I went over to the Back to the Future slot machine, and I chose that one at random, better than the pink and fluffy bridal bouquet slot machine. I don't really know the difference between slot machines, and I don't really know anything about slot machines other than here's this slot where you put some money. So I stuck a dollar bill in there, and it ate my dollar bill. And then this video screen of, you know, the matching or not matching images went rolling past my screen. And then it announced that I had not won. So I thought, okay, that doesn't seem like a really fun investment of your dollar. So I thought, well, I have $3 and my plane's getting ready to board here in just a minute. So I'll put one more dollar in just to see what happens. So I put another dollar in because I'm stupid and push the button and the images roll by and it announced I won. And I thought, okay, so plane's getting ready to load. So I pushed the cash out button and it spat out this ticket that that announced to me that I had won 20 cents.
Wow.
So for a $2 investment, not bad, I'd say.
Better than some people do. You know, they have done, as you would well imagine, statistical analyses have been done on exactly how much money to give back is the sweet spot to keep people gambling. Obviously, if you give them back too much, then you're not making as much money as you could. And if you don't get them back enough, they get discouraged and won't play. And of course, you know, smart people like you and me aren't going to spend more than a dollar or two anyway. But if you want to take as much money as possible from those – that percentage of the population that's going to play the slot machines, you need to give back a certain golden mean. And I don't know what it is. And of course, okay. you know, the machines make a lot of noise and there's a lot of excitement because they want you to feel, they want everyone to know when somebody wins so that that's everyone right. feels that it could be their turn next.
Right.
And this is, you know, this is what they do. But of course, every day the house wins. You should try to explain this to people at my job when they would ask me if I wanted to buy a lottery ticket. I'd say every single week they hold a lottery, and every single week money moves from the population of people to buy lottery tickets to the population of people that sell. It never goes any other way. Do I want to join this population of people?
But this time it might, just for me. And
That is true.
You know, so I came home, I announced with pride to my wife, I'm a winner. So yeah, so that was my experience of getting. And but the thing is, you know, C.S. Lewis talks about his wonderful little book, The Screwtape Letters, which is, for those people who are not familiar with The Screwtape Letters, it's a series of letters from his abysmal undersecretary Screwtape to Wormwood, his nephew. Screwtape is a ranking bureaucrat in the lowerarchy of hell, and he's giving advice on how to tempt and damn a human soul to his nephew Wormwood, who is a junior tempter out in the field attempting to damn his first human soul.
And for those of you who have not read it, if you've ever seen any of the very mediocre imitations of the style of writing on Facebook or on the internet, The greatest trick the devil ever pulled was getting people to make very poor imitations.
It's true, Dave. It's true.
You really want to read the original.
Yes, yes. And it's really great. It has furnished some great iconography for my imagination as a practicing Christian. But one of the things, Lewis later on wrote a bit of commentary on how he conceived of the Screwtape Letters. And you know, complaints that he got and praise that he got about the Screwtape Letters. One complaint that he thought was hilarious was from a rather confused clergyman who wrote to the Manchester Garden saying that a Guardian complaining that a lot of the advice in this book appeared to him to be diabolical.
Yes.
Which I thought was magnificent, you know. And he also talked about one woman who he heard of who had been applying for a job and was asked to put down, you know, what kind of books she read. It was part of the job application to get a feel for who she was. And so she put down the Screwtape Letters. And when she was pressed further on why, her answer was, well, it was the shortest book I could find in the list that they gave me. And so, you know, that made him swell with pride too. But one of the things that he talks about is he had people come up to him afterwards and ask him, you know, how long had he studied moral theology and all the rest of it in order to have this grasp of the psychology of temptation. And his reply was from the Psalms. He said, "My heart, parentheses, I need no other, sheweth me the wickedness of the ungodly."
Yes.
And that's how he knew so much about temptation. And he added, and I thought it was very prescient, he said, this is all coming back to my story about Reno. So my point, and I do have one, is this, that he was asked why he hadn't, for example, talked about the psychology, the temptation of, you know, gambling. Why didn't you talk about gambling? How come you don't discuss homosexuality anywhere in this book? And he said, because I've never experienced any temptation in those areas. He says, when he was in the trenches in World War I, one of the things that he really deeply resented was officers who had no experience of the kinds of trials that the troops in the trenches were struggling with, sort of breezing in and giving them lots and lots of moral advice on things that they had never ever struggled with themselves. And so he resolved, when he was writing the Screwtape Letters, not to talk about temptation that he himself had never experienced. He said, "I'd never experienced a temptation to gambling or homosexuality, so I don't tell other people about what to do about those things because it's just never been an issue for me." To which, of course, then somebody said, So that means all the other sins that you talk about in the Screw Tape Letters. He says, that's right. You know, and I empathize with that because I'm the same way. Some people I know are scandalized that you would gamble in Reno. Don't you realize that this is, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And my response is, I really have I have no temptation in the realm of gambling, because every time I've ever attempted it, I always lose every time. And so the life lesson that I very quickly learned at a young age was, this is dumb. Don't try it, because all you're doing is throwing your money away. So consequently, I'm free. I got a couple bucks, and here's this dumb machine. I think we're going to try this.
You know, for entertainment purposes with disposable income, you know, it's, yeah.
You know,
what you say about C.S. Lewis is something that any good homilist, and I say good homilist more than a good person, a good priest, or a good clergyman, any good homilist is ultimately, 9 times out of 10, he's preaching to himself. He's preaching the lesson that he is either struggling with, or has struggled with, or needs to hear again. He's reaching out for that aspect of the truth that his own soul needs. And
right.
And you know, beware the clergyman who doesn't see the need that he himself has, and you know, is telling you what he thinks you need.
Oh, yeah.
Very often it's, you know, because then that's what God does. God gives us the insights to help other people through the things that we struggle with and struggle through ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, back when I spent about 10 years arguing with a lot of people about the morality of torture.
Yes.
And people, you know, why do you spend so much time on this? And I told people a couple of times, they didn't believe me. But, you know, one of the reasons that I argued about it is because there are situations in which I can imagine myself doing that to certain people. Dylan Roof, frankly, is one of them.
Oh, sure.
I recognize the temptation, you know, because it's there in me, and that's why it has to be resisted. We'll be back in just a minute. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Deacon Stephen Gerdanis, and we'll be back on Breadbox Media right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Shay, and we are here today. We're back with Deacon Stephen Gerdanis. He is the owner and proprietor of decentfilms.com. He writes for the National Catholic Register. You write for Crux, Catholic Digest sometimes. Where else do you turn up these days?
Those are the main places. Every once in a while, I'll do something at Catholic World Report or some other outlet. But mainly, I'm at the National Catholic Register almost every week. And then every once in a while, I'll turn up at Crux. And I'm every month at the moment in Catholic Digest.
Oh, very, very good.
Yeah.
And you've got a new essay out talking about looking back at some of the very busy year that we've had in religious film.
That is true. And this is something that I take stock of every year. At the end of the year, I look back at the religious themes in the movie year that was as part of my overall assessment of what kind of movie year was it. Mm-hmm. And 2016, and you know, some years are kind of dry and boring and there's not mm-hmm. a lot to talk about. And then other years it's much more interesting. And this has been, I've been doing this now for 17 years and I can't think of another year like 2016. And some of the films that we're going to talk about, I have written a new column that's going up on Crux hopefully tomorrow that talks mm-hmm. about movies like Silence, mm-hmm. Like Hacksaw Ridge, Birth of a Nation, The Innocents, and then others, The Witch, The Conjuring 2, Queen of Katwe, and so on. But in addition to those, and those are all important and worth talking about from this perspective, there's also been this really remarkable string of films that actually depict Jesus Christ, that deal with Jesus as a character or that deal with him in some way mm-hmm. on screen. And I can't think of another year in the history of cinema, probably going back all the way to the silent era, in which there have been so many of these films. And as my friend Peter Chataway pointed out, we even had two of them in the top 10, the box office top 10, at the same time, which I don't think has ever happened before.
Isn't that remarkable? Yeah.
It's really, really odd. And the funniest thing is that it began with a Coen Brothers film.
the Coen Brothers have spent an awful lot of time exploring biblical themes.
They have.
But you're right. And I, by the way, and I thought it was, I really enjoyed it. Hail Caesar is the film that we're talking about.
It's a semi-musical comedy set in 1950s Hollywood that deals with the style of films that were being made at that time, with Gene Kelly dance extravaganzas and singing cowboys and big opulent musicals and so forth. But one genre that it deals with is the biblical epic in the style of Ben-Hur or The Robe. And right. In many of these films, because of sensitivities about dealing with Jesus as a character, the film would kind of offset the savior. It would focus on another character, usually a non-believer, a so-called good pagan. And that person's conversion process through encounters with Jesus or through encounters with the Christian community. And in right. the movie Hail Caesar, they deal with the making of such an epic with George Clooney not playing a Roman soldier, but playing an actor who plays a Roman soldier in a film within the film.
That is not also the brightest bulb in the marquee either.
Yeah. but the scene that you're referring to, there could be many scenes you're referring to, but one in particular, this is like the big climax to the film within a film, Hail Caesar, A Tale of the Christ. Clooney is at the foot of the cross and he's looking up and he's had an epiphany, this spiritual epiphany, and he's staring up at the Savior. And there's a great shot when the filmmakers are showing B-roll and footage stuff in versions of the film that's incomplete. There's a scene where it says divine presence to be filmed. But Clooney is staring up with this look of rapt awe and amazement, and he's making this big speech. It's the big finish to the film, and there's a word at the end, and he gets to the end and he can't think of the word. And the shot is ruined, and they have. But the joke, of course, is that the word is faith.
Yes.
Until that point, the scene is, even though you've had no drama up, you have no context on this, Clooney makes it moving, and it really shows you the spiritual power of cinema, even when the filmmakers who are doing it don't really get the point.
It's true. Well, and you know, this is something. Both Plato and also, Socrates, Plato speaking through Socrates, and also Dorothy Sayers talk about is the way in which an artist can, how should you put it? Christians might call it a charism. The Greeks called it a muse, but the way in which an artist can speak a profound truth and not know what he's, not himself be able to articulate how he's doing it.
Yes.
I remember years ago watching, it was like the, it was the, you know, the sort of, How We Made It stuff that they always stuck on CDs, or DVDs of films. And, I watched Forrest Gump, and I think that Tom Hanks just did something magical in Forrest Gump. His performance, I thought, was really, really great. And what was striking to me was in the sort of, you know, how did you do this interviews with Hanks on the DVD, it was very clear that he himself didn't have a clue what he was doing. He simply did it. But he didn't know how he made that performance, and he couldn't articulate what was going on in the film very well. And it was very striking to me. And my first thought was Dorothy Sayers and her discussion in Mind of the Maker of how an artist works. And it's not necessarily the case that the artist can articulate how they did what they did, because it's the doing that matters. It's not the analysis of it later on. And I thought that was really fascinating. So anyway.
So and that's not the only element that's of Christological significance in the film. There's a wonderfully comic and yet also theologically well-informed roundtable discussion of the kind that Hollywood really did at this point in history to kind of cover their bases and keep various religious groups happy. The protagonist of the film, who's a studio fixer played by Josh Brolin, brings in a number of religious consultants. There is a Catholic priest. There is an Orthodox bishop. He's
a great rabbi.
Yes, he's actually a Not just a bishop, but a patriarch, they say. There's the Jewish rabbi and a Protestant minister, and they're debating Jesus and his divinity or lack thereof in the portrayal of God in cinema and so forth. And it's obvious that, you know, they're all caricatures of one kind or another, but well-informed caricatures. And that's the pleasure of watching a Coen Brothers, is that whether they're being, you know, silly or scary or whatever it is, they're really smart and they bring a lot of knowledge of their subject to whatever they do. So that was, Hail Caesar. And the hilarious thing is that in a way, they almost wound up stealing the thunder from three other Jesus films that followed, that also followed very much in the footsteps of this kind of good pagan conversion Christological movie. Right. And these include Risen, where Joseph Fiennes plays the Roman soldier, a centurion who is tasked after the crucifixion of Jesus with finding out what happened to his body, to The Young Messiah, where Sean Bean plays a Roman soldier. No, he's the centurion. Fiennes' character is not a centurion. He's just a tribune. So Sean Bean plays a centurion who is tasked by Herod 7 years after the slaughter of the innocents in Bethlehem with tracking down the source of the rumors that a boy might have escaped and finishing the job. And then there's a third good pagan movie. It's not really a good pagan movie because the character Judah Ben-Hur is not a pagan. He's a Jew. But the same kind of story, a non-Christian whose encounters with Jesus spiritually transforms him by the end.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And that trope, you're right, of the outlooker or the onlooker looking in from the outside. That's a beloved and it's a very effective storytelling device written for a culture that's been Christian for a long time.
Yes.
Yeah. So anyway, we will return after this, listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Deacon Stephen Gardanus, and we'll be back on Breadbox Media right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Hello, and welcome back. Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We are here today with Stephen Gardanus. Late breaking news. It looks like Paul Anka will not be singing My Way at the inauguration. A nation.
How about that?
Devastated nation is heartbroken. but we're just going to move on. So let's continue. We've been talking about the remarkable explosion of religious films this past year.
And in particular of films dealing with Jesus as a character, putting Jesus himself on the screen. Now, of these, and in addition to the ones that we've mentioned so far, the kind of good pagan conversion movies, there a few others also warrant mention. There was Rodrigo Garcia's Last Days in the Desert, an art house film that you might not necessarily mention if it weren't Ewan McGregor, who's playing Jesus, and which always makes me think of that Facebook meme with the picture of Obi-Wan Kenobi on the grandmother's mantelpiece. With the grandchildren not being able to tell her that this is not Jesus.
That's right. Or about a week ago, did you hear about this Brazilian grandmother who had a plastic Elrond, the High Elven King action figure
yes.
that she had built a little shrine for under the impression that this was Saint Anthony and had been praying to the Elrond plastic action figure, which I think is adorable. But
this time Ewan McGregor really is Jesus, and he's also the devil, and this is the Jesus trials in the desert, although the canonical trials are not here. It's a completely different story. It's an art house film. And then there were some other much lesser known ones. But of all of these, I think there are really only two that I can recommend. And I'll give a sort of a half recommendation to Risen, which some people really liked. I thought that it had some interesting ideas in the first half as Joseph finds his Roman soldiers going around looking for Jesus. But once Jesus shows up, the movie kind of falls apart in the second half because it doesn't really have any idea of what to do with Jesus as a character, how to make him transcendent. He really kind of comes off like, you know, a generic Gandalf, Yoda type enlightened figure, but not very enlightened. Mm-hmm. And then they haven't made the main character interesting enough for his redemptive arc to have much weight. So that kind of falls. But there were two that I really liked. And one of them we already talked about, and that was Hail Caesar. And the other one that I really liked was The Young Messiah, which deals with Jesus as a 7-year-old coming back with the Holy Family from Egypt, from Alexandria, where he is, according to Anne Rice in the novel Christ Lord Out of Egypt that the story is based on, and coming back up to Nazareth and being pursued. And this is an invention for the film to give it a little more action excitement by this Roman soldier, the centurion played by Sean Bean, who for once, you know, gets to play out the whole movie and not die. And I really like, there are so many things I like about the film. I like the way that it portrays the Holy Family at this point in its history. It deals convincingly with Jesus' humanity and explores the question, and we talked about this in the show when it was in theaters, it explores the question of the relationship of Jesus' divine knowledge to his human knowledge. And it focuses on the fact that as a human being, he learned, he grew in wisdom. And so there were things that, humanly speaking, at certain points in his development, he did not know. This is controversial. Some Catholics said this is heretical, this is blasphemous. I don't think that it is. But even if you think that it is, it's an artistic interpretation. It's an imaginative presentation. It's not the catechism. And I found it really moving and well done.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Yes, that I didn't get a chance to see that in the theater, but the nice thing about Amazon Prime is you can always find these things. You know, speaking of which, just as an aside, Netflix is doing interesting things as well. They just did a biography of Pope Francis, you know, sort of young Pope, young Father Francis kind of thing.
Ah, yes.
Which I haven't seen yet. But
not the young Pope. This is not that.
No. Not the young Pope. Totally not that one. No, this is it's sort of a biopic of Jorge Bergoglio when he's growing up in Argentina. Yes, a very different thing than the young Pope.
There is a lot of good stuff going on the small screen, and in my follow-up piece for Crux that's hopefully going up tomorrow, I linked to a piece by Alyssa Wilkinson, formerly of Christianity Today, now writing for Vox. And she writes about religious themes not only in the movies but also on the small screen in shows like Daredevil and so forth, which is really beyond my ken. But I recommend that piece. So in addition to these Jesus films, we've also seen a number of movies in 2016 dealing with Christian characters, including consecrated religious and clergy, struggling with suffering and evil and with man's inhumanity to man. And of course, currently in theaters, and we talked about this recently, is Martin Scorsese's Silence.
Yeah.
Also Mel Gibson's Hacksaw Ridge, also starring Andrew Garfield. There was also Nate Parker's The Birth of a Nation, not to be confused with D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation. This is the story of the Nat Turner slave revolt, and it deals extensively with Nat Turner's religious beliefs and how he believed that he was called by God to lead an uprising to bring an end to the great evil of slavery. And there was also The Innocents, a Polish film by Anne Fontaine, set in World War II during the so-called liberation of Poland, that dealt with the phenomenon of the Nazi army just invading Poland and the widespread rape and sexual abuse that took place during this time. And and this included in this film invading a convent, and some of the nuns became pregnant as a result. And this this is based on a true story, a French Red Cross doctor whose diaries about this event led to the film. And
really?
Yeah.
I was going to say, one of the things I was very struck by, speaking of Silence, and you've written about this, of course, is Andrew Garfield talks about his preparation for playing a priest, a Jesuit.
Yes.
And Andrew Garfield, he's a Jewish guy, knew nothing about Catholic spirituality, knew nothing about Jesuits or anything. But in preparing for the role, he describes himself as having fallen in love with Jesus in doing the Ignatian exercises. And it was really his first encounter with the person of Jesus. Was doing this, and he, I read this interview with him, and you just come away going, I've talked on the show in the past about Sherry Waddell's book Forming Intentional Disciples, and she talks about the various thresholds that people go through on their way to becoming disciples, and this, everything centers around the encounter with Jesus. And Garfield is very clearly someone who has passed through a number of these thresholds in exactly the way that any evangelist hopes and prays a human being will do in their encounter with Jesus. And so I watched this interview and with him, ran on Catholic News Services, I think, CNS. And in the course of it, you know, he remarks that he's really appalled. He was appalled by Donald Trump's hostility to the Pope. And he says, you know, when you're fighting with the Pope, you're fighting with Jesus. This is a non-Catholic talking.
Yes, you know? A non-Christian.
A non-Christian talking. What struck me was the response of all the people in the comm boxes were all Catholics, and they were all, you know, telling him to shut up and, you know, who needs you and all of that. And I'm just going, these people's minds are 1,000 miles away from the Catholic evangelical mandate to bear witness to these guys aren't thinking at all about somebody who is really, at the end of the day, he's somebody who loves Jesus and is striving to think like him.
This is something that someone that you know, I have not met her in person, but I've met her online, but you've met her in person, Leah Labresco.
Oh, yeah.
Her conversion was also facilitated through imagination. Mm-hmm. When she was struggling with the idea of, can I believe the Catholic faith, one of the stages that she passed through was a kind of a role-playing stage, mm-hmm. where she took on the role of thinking as a Catholic in an imaginative way.
Right.
And this is a powerful thing. It's a thing that is for actors, particularly those who engage in method acting, where you really immerse yourself in the role and the character and the worldview,
right.
It can be spiritually dangerous, depending on where you go with it.
Yes.
On the other hand, you know, it can be redemptive.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we'll talk about this more when we return. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Deacon Stephen Gradonis talking about the bumper crop of religious films from last year. And we'll be back right after this.
If you enjoy listening to Mark Shea and all of his wonderful co-hosts here on Connecting the Dots, then consider becoming a friend of the show and provide your support today. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show. Thank you.
Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Deacon Stephen Gradonis. Got a bit of film-related news that just came in over the wire for me, which is that William Peter Blatty, the author of The Exorcist, I think he also wrote the screenplay, didn't he?
Yes, I believe that's correct. Yes.
And he also, there was something else that he wrote a Pink Panther movie, which I totally did not know.
Yes.
William Peter Blatty has died.
He has.
89 years old. So a long life.
Yeah. And the novel for The Exorcist the film is very well thought of by a lot of people. The novel, from what I understand, is even better and more theologically rich. And he brought a lot of a lot of depth to what he did. And it's interesting because The Exorcist really was the beginning. It wasn't just a groundbreaking movie. It was the first in a genre of films that use the powers of darkness as a kind of a backdoor to the question of God, mm-hmm. As a way of cross-examining modern secularism. That's really what's going on in The Exorcist. The Exorcist is the story of a modern secular woman who's, you know, when her daughter has a problem, her attitude is you just take your pills and you'll be fine. Mm-hmm. And the message of The Exorcist is that there's not a pill for everything. And this is a genre which, you know, continues to be very successful today. And this past year, we saw a very traditional film in that style, The Conjuring 2 by James Wan. It's the sequel to the very successful original film with Vera Farmiga and Patrick Wilson as devoutly Catholic paranormal investigators, husband and wife, Ed and Lorraine Warren. At least that's how they're presented in the films. Mm-hmm. And they investigate demons. But there were also a couple of very, very different films that do something similar. One of that I'm talking about in my write-up of the religious films of 2016. One of them was by it's a debut film of a filmmaker named Robert Eggers, and it's called The Witch.
I've heard of it, but I don't know anything about it.
It is appearing on a lot of critics' top 10 lists, including mine. It is an utterly unique horror film. It is set in 17th century New England, and it is based closely on folk tales and sources from the period, drawn from Puritan culture. And I have never seen a film that makes the specific worldview and the fears and even the language of New England's Puritanism so vividly realized. This is a film that really it's not like a typical period piece where essentially you have people, modern people, playing dress up. You're going to feel when you watch it like you're in the 17th century, and I think that's a really good thing.
Interesting. Well, I'd like to see that. That would be interesting. One of the things that I really appreciate is a film that either is dealing with a culture that we're not familiar with or a time period that we're not familiar with that doesn't just, you know, doesn't look down on it from the platform of, you know, early 21st century and just say, weren't they all stupid?
Yes.
Because that happens so often, and it's so tiring to me, to the refusal to make the effort to try to think like somebody would have thought in that time or place. So, you know, in a slightly different vein, one of the films that I really deeply appreciated was Robert Duvall's The Apostle.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
For a similar reason. Film. Because that is a film when I watched it, I thought to myself, he has to have spent time somehow or other at some point in his life in that subculture because he gets it so well.
Right.
And he doesn't sneer at it. He doesn't sneer at those people. He really, he gets inside the skin of that guy so well.
Witch doesn't, very much like that. It doesn't sneer at the Puritans, but at the same time, it is a critique of the Puritan culture and of this particular family. It's not, you know, so much so that some people have seen it as a kind of, you know, triumphant pro-Satan, pro-feminist, pro-witchcraft denunciation of Christianity.
Right.
And I think it's very clear when you watch the film that the movie is aware, first of all, that this family is not the typical Puritan family. The very first scene shows them getting essentially kicked out of the plantation by the village elders, and he denounces them all. And we're programmed by Hollywood convention to think, oh, like the proud righteous loner condemning society. But what if it's the other way around? I mean, this is a kind of a messed up family. And as the story goes on, this is very important to the fact that they are vulnerable to the devil. Mm-hmm. They're vulnerable because they bring their vulnerability with them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think that's really important.
Oh, wow. That sounds very interesting then.
And the devil is real, and the witchcraft is real, and they're super, super evil. Anybody who misses that didn't watch the film.
Okay, that's intriguing. All right, I will. I'm gonna have to check that one out then. I've really appreciated it when on those rare occasions when it happens, and it is rare. I mean, you know, my typical experience of a historical film, quasi historical, obviously not really historical, but you know, are things like. Oh, what am I thinking? There was one about the Crusades a couple of years ago with Orlando Bloom.
Yes, that was actually 12 years ago now.
Yeah. Well, you can tell how close attention I paid to it, but it was just frustrating to me. Yeah, Kingdom of Heaven. Those things are frustrating to me.
Yes.
And you know, Kevin Costner's Robin Hood is like the archetypal example of this, you know, with the kick but Maid Marian, you know, and years ago, back in the early 80s, there was a TV film that was made of Jim Bishop's The Day Christ Died.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just hideous. You know, it literally has at one point, it has Jesus looking at Judas Iscariot and saying, "You're the only one who ever really understood me." And Bishop, you know, when they made it, Bishop just like completely disowned it. Bishop was a Catholic. And he'd written this basically, you know, as close to the facts as he could get, kind of hour by hour description of Good Friday, Holy Thursday and Good Friday. He did done other books like that, like The Day Lincoln Was Shot. And they came out with this film that really all it had in common with his book was the title. And he just disowned the whole thing. But yeah, that's what I'm used to. When Hollywood tries to tackle history, it always embarrasses me.
Yes, The Witch is very, very good. It's very disturbing. I don't want to underplay that. I was really rattled after seeing it. Some people who want a typical horror movie felt cheated. They felt like they didn't get what they wanted. And the director, Eggers, said something really funny about that. He said that, you know, what we expect of horror is something that wouldn't include someone like Edgar Allan Poe. And what interests him is dealing with what's actually horrifying about humanity instead of shining a flashlight on it and running away giggling.
Mm.
So that's what you're going to get in The Witch. You're going to get a serious art film that deals with the reality of evil and the fallen human condition.
Mm.
And what's wrong with Calvinism and what's even worse with the devil. So, you know, and then there were – This was, I think, an important film. Other films that dealt with religious themes in 2016 include Scott Derrickson's Doctor Strange, which uses comic book mysticism as a metaphor to cross-examine the protagonist's materialistic nihilism. You know, there is no such thing as spirit. We are made of matter and nothing more. Okay, no.
I beg to differ.
You can even find semi-religious themes in Disney's other two of Disney's other big films last year. Well, actually three of them in Pete's Dragon, in The Jungle Book, in metaphorical form, but also very explicitly in Queen of Katwe, directed by Mira Nair, about Ugandan female chess champion Fiona Mutesi, which is just a great, great film. And everyone listening, you should go to Amazon and you should watch Queen of Katwe. I promise you, you will not be sorry. If you are, write to me and I'll send you your money back. Up to a point. We'll have to see.
Okay, I saw it a dozen times and I hated it every time. Give me my money.
So. But Queen of Katwe, I guarantee you'll like it.
Very good. All right, cool. Well, we got about a minute left. Anything else you want to highlight for us?
You know, there were some other films. Not all of them, it's occurring to me, that I actually dealt with in my column. I'm now regretting that I never got to Paths of the Soul, which is a documentary about Buddhists on pilgrimage.
Okay. All right. Well, maybe we talk about that next week. I want to thank you, Deacon Stephen Gradonis, for being on the show today. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. Our producer today was Mr. Danny Head, and I'm your host, Mark Shea. We'll be back on Monday with more excitement. Until then, have a great weekend. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.